Suddenly, men were pouring from the doorway. Richard's men were ready and fell on them, driving the wooden weapons into their soft underbellies and snapping the handles off as man after man spilled out of the doorway. Standing to the side of the door, others used their maces to bash in the skulls of soldiers who emerged. When one soldier came out with his sword raised, the man to the side clubbed his arm as another rushed in and drove a wooden stake in up under his ribs. The more men who fell at the doorway, the more those trying to get out were slowed and could be dispatched. The soldiers were so stunned to see these people fighting that in some cases they fought back only ineffectually. As a soldier leaped over the bodies in the doorway and lifted a sword, a man jumped on his back and seized his arm while another stabbed him. Another, crying orders, charged Jensen, only to have the bolt of a crossbow fired into his face. A few soldiers escaped the burning building and managed to slip past Richard's men, only to meet Kara's Ajil. Their screams, worse than the cries of men on fire, briefly brought the gaze of every man from both sides of the battle. Fallen knives and swords were scooped up by the men of the town and turned on the men from the Imperial Order. Richard fired an arrow into the center of the chest of a man emerging from the smoke that rolled out of the doorway. As he was falling, a second arrow felled the man behind him. As more men rushed out, they fell over those piled around the doorway and were hacked to death with commandeered axes or stabbed with confiscated swords. Since they could emerge only one at a time, the soldiers couldn't mount a coordinated attack, but those waiting could. As Richard's men fought back those struggling to get out of the doorway to the burning building, other men rushed to help lift the gate so those under it could get up and get control of it. Once the gate was lifted, the men swung it around and, with a cry of joint effort, ran with it toward the building. They drove the top up under the eaves first, but when they brought the bottom edge down, the bodies piled in the doorway prevented them from getting the bottom down so they could wedge it in place. Richard called out orders. Some of his men rushed in and seized an arm or a leg of a dead man and dragged the body aside so the others could finally bring the bottom of the gate down against the building to close off the doorway. One man from inside squeezed through just before they had the gate in place. The weight of the door pinned him against the building. Owen leaned in and with a sword he'd picked up decisively stabbed the man through the throat. As men inside pounded at the gate covering the doorway and threw their weight against it, men on the outside piled around to push it down and hold it in place. Other men fell to their knees and drove stakes into the ground to lock the gate section in place, trapping the soldiers inside. Behind, streamers of flame leaked out from under the eaves of the first building and leaped up into the night sky. The roof of the building ignited all at once, explosively engulfing the entire sleeping house in sparks and flames. Screams of men being burned alive ripped the night. The waves of heat coming off the massive fire as the first building was consumed by the flames began to carry the heavy aroma of cooking meat. It reminded Richard that, for the killing he did, his gift demanded the balance of not eating meat. After all the killing of this night, since his gift was already spinning out of control, he would have to be even more careful to avoid eating any meat. His head was already hurting so much that he was having trouble focusing his vision. He couldn't afford to do anything that would further unbalance his gift. If he was not careful, the poison wouldn't get the chance to be the first to kill him. Heavy black smoke billowed out from around the edges of the gate covering the doorway of the second sleeping house. Screams and pleas came from inside. The men of the town moved back, watching, as smoke began rolling up from under its eaves. The battle seemed to have ended as quickly as it had started. No one spoke as they stood in the harsh glare from the roaring fires. Flames ate through the second building. With a loud whoosh, it was engulfed in fire. The heat drove everyone back away from the two sleeping houses. As they moved back from the burning buildings, they encountered the rest of the people of the town, all gathered in the shadows, watching in stunned silence. One of the older men took a step forward. "Speaker Owen, what is this? You have committed violence?" Owen stepped away from the men he was with to stand before the people of his town. He held an arm back, pointing toward Richard. "This is Lord Rall of the Daharan Empire. I went in search of him to help us be free. We have much to tell you, but for now you must know that tonight, for the first time in many seasons, our town is free. Yes, we have helped Lord Rawl to kill the evil men who have terrorized us. We have avenged the deaths of our loved ones. We will no longer be victims. We will be free. Standing silently, the people seemed able only to stare at him. Many looked confused. Some looked quietly jubilant, but most just looked stunned. The boy, Bernie, ran up to Anson, peering up in astonishment.
Anson, you and our other people have freed us, truly?
Yes. He laid a hand on Bernie's shoulder. Our town is now free.
Thank you.
He broke into a grin as he turned back to the town's people.
We are free of the murderers.
A sudden, spontaneous cheer rose into the night, drowning out the sound of the crackling flames. The people rushed in around men they had not seen for months, touching them, hugging them, all asking questions of the men. Richard took Kalin's hand as he stepped back out of the way, joining Kara, Jensen, and Tom. These people, who were so against violence, who lived their whole life avoiding the truth of what their beliefs caused, were now basking in the tearful joy of what it really meant to be freed from terror and violence. People slowly left their men to come and look at Richard and those standing with him. He and Kalin smiled at their obvious joy. They gathered in close before him, smiling, staring, as if Richard and those with him were some strange creatures from afar. Bernie had attached himself to Anson's arm. Others had the rest of the men firmly embraced. One by one, though, the men started pulling away so that they could stand behind Richard and Kalin.
We are so happy that you are home now, people were telling the men. We have you back at last.
Now we are all together again, Bernie said.
We can't stay, Anson told him.
One by one, everyone in the crowd fell silent. Bernie, like many of the others, looked heartbroken.
What?
Buzzing, worried whispers spread through the crowd. Everyone was shaken by the news that the men were not home to stay. Owen lifted a hand so they would listen. When they went silent, he explained.
The people of Bandakar are still under the cruel power of the men from the Order. Just as you have become free tonight, so must the rest of the people of Bandakar be free. Lord Rawl and his wife, the Mother Confessor, as well as his friend and protector Kara, his sister Jensen and Tom, another friend and protector, have all agreed to help us. They cannot do it alone. We must be part of it. For this is our land, but more importantly, our people, our loved ones.
Owen, you must not engage in violence, an older man said.
In view of their sudden freedom, it was not an empathic statement. It seemed to be an objection, more out of obligation than anything else.
You have begun a cycle of violence. Such a thing is wrong.
We will speak with you before we go, so that you might come to understand, as we have, why we must do this to truly be free of violence and brutality. Lord Rawl has shown us that a cycle of violence is not the result of fighting back for your own life, but is the result of a shrinking back from doing what is necessary to crush those who would kill you. If you do as you must in duty to yourself and your loved ones, then you will eradicate the enemy so completely that they can no longer do you any harm. Then there is no cycle of violence, but an end to violence. Then and only then will true peace and freedom take root.
Such actions can never accomplish anything but to start violence,
an old man objected.
Look around, Anson said. The violence has not begun tonight, but ended. Violence has been crushed, as it should be, by crushing evil men who bring it upon us.
People nodded to one another. The heady relief of being suddenly freed from the grip of the terror brought by the soldiers of the Imperial Order plainly overcoming their objections. Joy had taken over from fear. The reality of having their lives returned had opened their eyes.
But you must understand, as we have come to understand, Owen said, that nothing can ever again be the way it once was. Those ways are in the past.
Richard noticed that the men weren't slouching anymore. They stood with their heads held high.
We have chosen to live, Owen told his people. In so doing, we have found true freedom.
I think we all have, the old man in the crowd said.
Chapter 49. Zed frowned with the effort of concentrating on what it was Sister Tahira had placed on the table before him. He looked up at her, at the way her scowl pinched in around her humped nose.
Well? She demanded. Zed looked down, squinting at the thing before him. It looked like a leather-covered ball painted with faded blue and pink zigzagged lines all around it. What was it about it that seemed so familiar yet so distant? He blinked, trying to better focus his eyes. His neck ached something fierce. A father, hearing his young son in the next tent screaming in appalling agony, had grabbed Zed by the hair and yanked him away from other parents who, pulling and pawing at him, made desperate demands of their own. With the torn muscles in his neck, it was painful to hold up his head. Compared to the torture he heard, though, it was nothing. The dim interior of the tent, lit by several lamps hanging from poles, felt as if it were detached from the ground and swirling around him. The foul place stank. The heat and humidity only made the smell and the spinning worse. Zed felt as if he might pass out. It had been so long since he'd slept that he couldn't even remember the last time he had actually lain down. The only sleep he got was when he fell asleep in the chair while Sister Tahira was seeing to another object being unloaded from the wagons, or when she went to bed and the next sister hadn't yet arrived to take the next stint in their laborious cataloging of the items brought from the keep. The catnaps he got were rarely longer than a few precious minutes at a time. The guards had orders not to allow him or Addy to lie down. At least the screams of the children had ended. At least, as long as he cooperated, those cries of pain had stopped. At least, as long as he went along, the parents had hope. A violent crack of pain suddenly hammered the side of his head, knocking him back. The chair toppled over, spilling him to the ground. With his arms bound behind his back, he couldn't do anything to break the fall, and he hit hard. Zed's ears rang, not only from the fall, but with the aftermath of the blow of the sister's power delivered through the collar around his neck. He hated that wicked instrument of control. The sisters were not shy about exercising that control. Because the collar locked him away from the use of his own gift, he could not use his ability to defend himself. Instead, they used his power against him. It took little or no provocation to send one of the sisters into a fit of violence. Many of these women had once been kindly people devoting their lives to helping others. Jagang had enslaved them to a different cause. Now, they did his bidding. Though they might have once been gentle, they were now, he knew, trying to keep one step ahead of the discipline Jagang meted out to them. That discipline could be excruciating beyond endurance. The sisters were expected to get results. Jagang would not be interested in the excuse that Zed was being difficult. Zed saw that Addy, too, had been knocked to the ground. Any punishment he received, she, too, endured. He felt more agony for her than for himself. Soldiers standing to the side moved in to right the chair and lift Zed into it. With his arms bound behind his back, he couldn't get up by himself. They sat him down hard enough to drive a grunt from his lungs. "Well?" Sister Tahira demanded. "What is it?" Zed once again leaned in, staring down at the round object sitting by itself in the center of the table. The faint blue and pink lines zigzagging all around it stirred deep feelings. He thought he should know this thing.
It's what?"
Sister Tahira slammed the book against the edge of the table, causing the round object to bounce up and roll a few inches before it came to a stop closer to Zed. She tucked the book under one arm as she leaned with the other on the table. She bent down toward him.
"What is it? What does it do?"
I can't remember."
"Would you like me to bring in some children?"
the sister said in the soft, sweet tone of a very bitter threat.
"And show you their little faces before they are taken to the tent next to us to be tortured?"
"I'm so tired," he said. "I'm trying to remember, but I'm so tired."
"Maybe while the children are screaming, you would like to explain to their parents that you are tired and just can't quite seem to remember."
Children. Parents. Zed suddenly remembered what the object was. Painful memories welled up. He felt a tear run down his cheek.
"Dear spirits," he whispered, "where did you find this?"
"What is it?
Where did you find it?"
Zed repeated. Huffing impatiently, the sister straightened. She opened the book and made a noisy show of turning heatedly through the pages. Finally, she stopped and tapped a finger in the open book.
It says here that it was found hidden in an open recess in the back of a black six-drawer chest in a corridor. There was a tapestry of three prancing white horses hanging above the chest.
She lowered the book.
Now what is it?
Zed swallowed.
A ball.
The sister glared.
I know it's a ball, you old fool. What is it for? What does it do? What is its purpose?
Staring at the ball no bigger than his fist, Zed remembered.
It's a ball for children to play with. Its purpose is to bring them pleasure.
He remembered this ball, brightly colored back then, frequently bouncing down the halls of the wizard's keep, his daughter giggling and chasing after it. He had given it to her for doing well in her studies. Sometimes she would roll it down the halls, urging it along with a switch, as if she were walking a pet. Her favorite thing to do was to bounce it on the floor so that it would come up against a wall, after which it would bounce to another wall at an intersection of stone hallways. In that way, she made it bounce around a corner. She would watch which hall it went down, left or right, then chase after it. One day she came to him in tears. He asked her to tell him her troubles. She crawled up in his lap and told him that her ball had gone somewhere and got itself lost. She wanted him to get it unlost. Zed told her that if she looked, she would likely find it. She spent days despondently wandering the halls of the keep searching for it. She couldn't find it. Finally, starting out one morning at sunrise, Zed made the long walk down to the city of Adendrill, to the market on Stenter Street. That was where he had first come across a stand where they sold such toys and found the ball with the zigzagged lines. There, he bought her another one, not just like it, but instead one with pink and green stars. He deliberately chose a ball unlike the one she'd lost because he didn't want her to think that wishes could be miraculously fulfilled. But he did want her to know that there were solutions that could solve problems. He remembered his daughter hugging his legs, thanking him for the new ball, telling him that he was the best father in all the world and that she would be ever so much more careful with the new ball and never lose it. He had smiled as he watched her put a little hand to her heart and recite a little girl oath she had invented on the spot. She treasured the ball with the pink and green stars, since it was small. It was one of the few things she had been able to take with her after she was grown, when she and Zed ran away to Westland, after Dark and Rawl had raped her. When Richard had been young, he had played with that ball. Zed remembered the smile on her face as she watched her son play with that precious ball. Zed could see in her beautiful eyes the memories of her own childhood as she watched Richard play. She had kept that ball her whole life, kept it until she died. This ball before him was the very same one his daughter had lost. It must have bounced up behind the chest and fallen into a recess in the back, where it had been for all those long years. Zed leaned forward, resting his forehead on the dusty ball surrounded with faded blue and pink zigzagged lines, the ball where her little fingers had once been, and wept. Sister Tahira seized a fistful of his hair and pulled him upright.
I don't believe you're telling me the truth. It's an object of magic. I want to know what it is and what it does.
Holding his head back, she glared into his eyes.
You know that I will not hesitate to do what is necessary to make you cooperate. His Excellency accepts no excuses for failure.
Zed stared up at her, blinking away his tears.
It's a ball, a toy. That's all it is.
With a sneer, she released him.
The great and powerful wizard Zarander.
She shook her head.
To think that we once feared you. You are a pathetic old man, your courage crushed by nothing more than the cry of a child.
She sighed.
I must say, your reputation far exceeds the reality of your mettle.
The sisters scooped up the ball, turning it in her fingers as she inspected it. She huffed with disgust and tossed it aside, as if it were worthless. Zed watched the ball bounce and roll across the ground, coming to rest at the side of the tent against the bench where Addie sat. He looked up into her completely white eyes to see her watching him. Zed turned away, waiting while the sister made notes in her book.
All right, she finally said. Let's go have a look at what they've unloaded in the next tent.
The soldiers lifted him from the chair before he had a chance to try to do it himself. His shoulders ached from his wrists being bound behind his back and from being lifted by his arms. Addie, too, was lifted to her feet. The book snapped closed. Sister Tahira's wiry gray hair whipped around as she turned and led them out of the tent. Because the sisters knew how dangerous items of magic from the wizard's keep could be, especially if the wrong combination of magic were to accidentally be allowed to combine or touch, they were cautious enough to bring the items one at a time out of each individual protected shielded crate in the wagons. Zed knew that there were things in the keep that by themselves were not dangerous, but became so in the presence of other things that by themselves were also not dangerous. Sometimes it was only the combination of specific items that created a desired outcome. The sisters had vast experience in the most esoteric things of magic, and so they at least understood the principles involved. They treated the cargo with the care due such potentially hazardous goods. Once each object was uncrated, they placed it by itself in a tent to await examination. They took Zed and Addie from tent to tent so that Zed could identify each treasure, tell them what it was, explain how it worked. They had been at it for days, how many Zed couldn't remember. Despite his best efforts, the endless days and nights had all begun to melt together in his mind. Zed did all he could to stall, but there was only so much he could do. These women knew magic. They would not easily be fooled by any invented explanation. They had made very clear the consequences of any such deception. And Zed didn't know how much they knew. At times they feigned ignorance of something which they actually understood quite well, just to see if he was telling the truth. Fortunately, as of yet, they had uncovered nothing that was extravagantly dangerous. Most of the items from the crates were simple-looking objects, but were actually for a narrowly focused purpose. A pole that could remotely judge the depth of water in a well, an iron decoration shaped like a fan of leaves that prevented words from carrying beyond an open door where it was placed, a large-looking glass that revealed when a person entered another room. While possibly useful to Emperor Jigang, such items were not all that valuable or dangerous. They were not going to help him to conquer and rule the world. What dangerous things the sisters had uncrated and shown him were not really anything that a sister couldn't easily produce with a spell of her own. The most dangerous item had been a constructed spell held within an ornate vase that, under specific conditions such as when filled with water, created a temperature inversion that produced a blast of flame. Zed was not betraying his cause or putting innocent lives at risk by revealing how the spell worked. Any sister worth her salt could reproduce the same effect. The purpose of the spell was protective. Had it touched other stolen items, which, because they were stolen, was a reversal of intended ownership that such a spell recognized, it would have ignited and destroyed those items, keeping them from covetous hands. None of the things so far discovered would do Jigang any real good. There were things in the keep, though, that could cause him harm. There were spells there, such as the constructed spell in the vase that recognized the nature of the person invoking their magic. Opened by the right person, such as Zed, those things would do nothing. But opened by a thief, they would create calamity. The keep had thousands of rooms. The looting of it had netted the Imperial Order a caravan of cargo wagons, but even that much hardly scratched the surface of the contents of the keep. So far, Zed had not seen any plums. He didn't know if he would live to see any. The ride in the box after his capture had been brutal. He was still not recovered from the injuries inflicted after meeting Jigang. Guards let the parents do what they would to convince Zed and Addie to give in, but they wouldn't allow the parents to get so carried away that they killed such prize prisoners. The parents had known that they weren't to kill them, but in the heat of such raw passion, Zed knew that such orders were easy to forget. Zed yearned for them to kill him and end it. The Emperor, though, needed them alive, so the guards stood careful watch. After the first few horrifying hours of listening to children being subjected to crippling torture, of being among their parents who understandably demanded quite forcefully that he cooperate and tell the Emperor what he wanted to know, Zed had given in. Not for the sake of the parents, so much as to stop those brutal men from what they were doing to the children. He had figured that he had nothing to lose, really, by giving in. It stopped the torture of the children for the time being. The keep was vast. The things they brought were only a tiny portion of them. Zed reasoned that the caravan of wagons probably didn't hold anything of real value to Jigang. It would take quite a while to catalog everything. It could be weeks more before they reached the last item. There was no purpose in allowing children to endure torture when there might not be anything useful for Zed to betray to Jigang. Once, when they were alone, while the sister had gone to check on the preparations in the next tent, Addy had asked what he would do if they presented him with something that would materially help Jigang win. Zed hadn't had a chance to answer. The soldiers had come in then and taken the two of them to the sister in the next tent. He was hoping to drag out the process for as long as possible. He hadn't counted on how they would keep at it day and night. It sometimes took quite a while for the sisters to get out the next treasure and have it ready. They were understandably cautious and took no chances. Those strange men without any trace of the gift who helped them might not be harmed if any errant item of magic were to accidentally be set in motion, but everyone else certainly was vulnerable. Careful as they were, there were enough people working at the preparations that Zed and Addy were not allowed to sleep for long before they were taken off to unravel the next puzzle for them. As he and Addy were dragged through the dark camp to the next tent, Zed's legs would hardly hold him. Seeing his daughter's long-lost ball had sapped much of his remaining strength. He had never felt so old, so feeble. He feared that his will to go on was flagging. He didn't know how much longer he could keep his sanity. He wasn't at all sure that he actually still possessed it. The world seemed to have turned into a crazy place. At times the whole thing seemed dreamlike. What he knew and what he didn't know sometimes seemed to have all twisted together into a knot of confusion. As he was marched through the dark camp, through the humid heat, he began to imagine that he saw things, mostly people from his past. He began to doubt that he really had seen that ball. He wondered if, like some of the other things he was seeing, he had imagined it as well. Could it maybe have been a simple ball, and he only thought that it was the one his daughter had lost? Had he imagined the zigzagged colors around it? He was beginning to question himself over every little thing. Looking up at all the people in the crowded encampment, he thought he saw his long-dead wife, Arilyn, in the faces of the women held nearby under guard. They were mothers, their worst nightmares ready to come to life if Zed didn't cooperate. His gaze passed over children clutching their mother's skirts or their father's legs. They looked at him, his wavy white hair in disarray, probably thinking he was some crazy man. Maybe he was. The torches lit the sprawling camp with a kind of flickering light that made everything seem imaginary. The campfires, spread as far as he could see, looked like a star field lying across the ground, as if the world had turned upside down. "Wait," the sister said to the guards. Zed was jerked to a halt as the sister ducked inside the tent. Addy cried out as the man holding her wrenched her arm in the act of stopping her. Zed swayed on his feet, wondering if he might pass out. The whole nighttime camp wavered in his vision. As he looked at one of the girls held captive across the way, he stared, astonished, thinking he recognized her. Zed looked up at the Emperor's elite guard in the distance holding the child. Zed blinked his blurred vision. The guard, in leather and mail armor, with a belt full of weapons, looked like a man Zed used to know. Zed turned away at the memory, only to see a sister making her way among the tents not far away, who also looked like someone else he knew. He looked around at soldiers going about their business. Elite soldiers guarding the Emperor's compound looked like men he thought he remembered. Zed truly was terrified then. He was sure that he was losing his mind. He couldn't possibly be seeing the people he thought he saw. His mind was all he had. He didn't want to be some babbling old man sitting by the side of a road begging. He knew that people sometimes became irrational, lost their mind, when they got old or were pressed past their endurance. He had known people who had snapped, who had gone insane and saw things that weren't really there. That's what he was doing. He was having visions of people from his past who weren't really there. That was a sure sign of insanity. Seeing your past come to life, thinking you were back with long-lost loved ones. His mind was the most important thing he had. Now, he was losing that too. He was losing his sanity. Chapter 50. Nicholas heard an annoying noise back in another place. A disturbance of some sort, back where his body waited. He ignored it, watching the streets, watching the buildings go by. The sun had just set. People, wary people, moved past. Color, sound, activity. It was a dingy place, with buildings crowded close. Watch, watch. Alleyways were dark and narrow. Strangers stared. The street smelled. None of the buildings were more than two stories, he was sure of it. Most were not even that. Again he heard the noise back where his body waited. It was forceful, calling his attention. He ignored the thump, thump, thump back somewhere else as he watched, trying to see where they were going. What's this? Watch, watch, watch. He thought he knew, but he wasn't positive. Look, look. He wanted to be sure. He wanted to watch. He so enjoyed watching. More noise. Obnoxious, demanding, thumping noise. Nicholas felt his body around him as he slammed back to where it waited, sitting cross-legged on the wooden floor. He opened his eyes, blinking, trying to see in the dim room, slivers of dusk leaking in around the edges of the closed shutters, lent only somber light to the room. He stood, wavering on his feet for a moment, not yet used to the strange feeling of being back in his own body. He started walking across the room, looking down, watching as he lifted each foot out ahead, shifted his weight with every step. He had been gone so much lately, day and night, that he was not used to having to do such things on his own. He had been so often in another place, another body, that he had difficulty adjusting to his own. Someone was banging on the door, yelling for him to open it. Nicholas was furious at the uninvited caller, at such a rude intrusion. With wobbly gait, he made his way to the door. It felt so confining being back in his own body. It moved in such an odd manner. He rolled his shoulders, resisting the urge to bend forward. He pulled and stretched his neck one way, then the other. It was bothersome to have to move himself about, to use his own muscles, to feel himself breathe, to see, hear, smell, feel with his own senses. The door was barred by a heavy bolt to prevent unwelcome callers from entering while he was off to other places. It wouldn't do to have someone messing with his body while he wasn't there using it himself. Wouldn't do at all. Someone pounding on the other side of the door bellowed his name and demanded to be let in. Nicholas lifted the heavy bolt and heaved it over. He threw open the thick door. A young soldier stood just outside in the hall, a common, grubby soldier, a nobody. Nicholas stared in stunned fury at the lowly man who would just walk up the stairs to the room everyone knew was off limits and pound on the forbidden door. Where was Najari's flat, crooked nose when he needed it? Why wasn't someone guarding the door? A broken bone jutted from the back of the bloody fist the man had been hammering against the door. Nicholas craned his neck, peering past the soldier out into the dimly lit hall, and saw the bodies of guards sprawled in pools of blood. Nicholas ran his fingernails back through his hair, shivering with delight at the silken, smooth feel of oils gliding against his palm. He rolled his shoulders with the pleasure of the sensation. Opening his eyes, he fixed his gaze on the wide-eyed common soldier whom he was about to kill. The man was dressed like many of the Imperial Order soldiers, at least the better outfitted soldiers, with leather chest armor, a sleeve of protective mail on his right arm, and a number of leather straps and belts, holding a variety of weapons from a short sword to a mace with a spiked metal head to knives. Despite how deadly all his gear appeared, the expression on his face was one of startled terror. Nicholas puzzled for a moment at what such a meaningless man could possibly have to say that would be worth his life.
"What is it, you insipid fool?"
The man lifted an arm, then the hand, then a single finger, in a manner that reminded Nicholas of nothing so much as a puppet having its string pulled. The finger tipped to one side, then the other, then back again, the way someone might waggle a finger in admonition. The finger twitched side to side again.
"Be polite. Be awfully polite."
The soldier, his eyes wide, seemed surprised by his own haughty words. The voice sounded too deep, too mature to belong to this young man. The voice, in fact, sounded dangerous in the extreme.
"What is this?"
Nicholas frowned at the soldier.
"What's this about?"
The man started into the room, his legs moving in a most peculiar, stilted manner. In some ways, it reminded Nicholas of how it must look when he used his own legs after not being in his body for a long spell. He stepped aside as the man walked woodenly into the center of the dim room and turned. Blood dripped from the hand that had been pounding against the door, but the man, his eyes still wide with fear, seemed not to notice what had to be painful injuries. His voice, though, came out anything but afraid.
"Where are they, Nicholas?"
Nicholas approached the man and cocked his head.
"They?
You promised them to me, Nicholas. I don't like it when people don't keep their word. Where are they?"
Nicholas drew his brow down even farther, leaned in even more.
"Who?"
"Richard Roll and the Mother Confessor,"
the soldier bellowed in unrestrained rage. Nicholas backed away a few paces. He understood now. He had heard the stories, heard that the man could do such things. Now he was seeing it for himself. This was Emperor Jagang, the Dreamwalker himself.
"Remarkable," Nicholas drawled.
He approached the soldier, who was not a soldier, and tapped a finger against the side of the man's head.
"That you in there, Your Excellency?"
He tapped the man's temple again.
"That's you, isn't it, Excellency?" "Where are they, Nicholas?"
It was as dangerous sounding a question as Nicholas had ever heard.
"I told you that you would have them, and you shall." "I think you're lying to me, Nicholas," the voice growled. "I don't think you have them as you promised you would."
Nicholas flipped a hand dismissively as he strolled off a few paces.
"Oh, foo! I have them by a string." "I think otherwise. I have reason to believe that they aren't down here at all. I have reason to believe that the Mother Confessor herself is far to the north with her army."
Nicholas frowned as he approached the man, leaning in close, peering into the eyes.
"Do you completely lose your senses when you go cavorting into another man's mind like that? Are you saying it isn't so?"
Nicholas was losing patience.
"I was just watching them when you barged in here to pester me. They were both there, Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor." "Are you sure?"
came the deep, gravelly voice out of the young soldier's mouth. Nicholas planted his fists on his hips.
"Are you questioning me? How dare you? I am Nicholas the Slide. I will not be questioned by anyone."
The soldier took an aggressive step forward. Nicholas held his ground and lifted a finger in warning.
"If you want them, then you had better be awfully careful."
The soldier watched with wide eyes. But Nicholas could see more in those eyes, menace.
"Talk, then, before I lose my patience."
Nicholas screwed his mouth up in annoyance.
"Whoever told you that they were to the north, that the Mother Confessor is with their army, either doesn't know what they're talking about or is lying to you. I've kept a careful eye on them. But have you seen them lately?"
The room was growing dark. Nicholas cast a hand toward the table, sending a small spark of his gift into three candles there, setting their wicks to flame.
I told you I was just watching them. They are in a city not far from here. Soon they will be coming here to me, and then I will have them. You don't have to wait long.
What makes you think they're coming to you?
I know everything they do.
Nicholas held his arms aloft, his black robes slipping up to his elbows, gesturing expansively as he walked around the man, speaking of what he alone knew.
I watch them. I have seen them lying together at night, the mother confessor tenderly holding her husband in her arms, holding his head to her shoulder, comforting his terrible pain. It is quite touching, actually.
His pain?
Yes, his pain.
They are in Northwick right now, a city not far to the north of here. When they are finished there, if they live through their visit, then they will be coming here, to me. Jagang and the soldier looked around. Taking in the freshly dead bodies lying against the wall, his attention returned to Nicholas.
I asked, what makes you think so?
Nicholas looked over his shoulder and lifted an eyebrow at the Emperor.
Well, you see, these fool people here, the pillars of creation who so fascinate you, have poisoned the poor Lord Rawl. They did it to try to ensure his help in getting rid of us.
Poisoned him? Are you sure?
Nicholas smiled at the note of interest he detected in the Emperor's voice.
Oh, yes, quite sure. The poor man is in a great deal of pain. He needs an antidote.
Then he will do what he must to get such an antidote. Richard Rawl is a surprisingly resourceful man.
Nicholas leaned his backside against the table and folded his arms.
He may be resourceful, but he's now in a great deal of trouble. You see, he needs two more doses of the antidote. One of them is in Northwick. That's why he went there.
You would be surprised at what that man can accomplish.
It would have been impossible to miss the bristling anger in the Emperor's voice.
You would be a fool to underestimate him, Nicholas.
Oh, but I never underestimate anyone, Excellency.
Nicholas smiled meaningfully at the Emperor, watching him through another man's eyes.
You see, I'm reasonably sure that Richard Rawl will retrieve the antidote in Northwick. In fact, I am counting on it. We shall see. I was watching him as you came in, watching what would happen. You spoiled it.
But even if he obtains the antidote in Northwick, he will still need to get the last dose.
The antidote in Northwick alone will not spare his life.
Where's this other dose of his antidote?
Nicholas reached in a pocket and showed the Emperor the square-sided bottle, along with a satisfied smile.
I have it.
The man with an Emperor inside him smiled.
He may come to take it from you, Nicholas, but more likely, he will have someone else make him more of the antidote, so that he won't even have to bother coming here.
Oh, I don't think so. You see, Excellency, I am quite thorough in my work. This poison that Lord Rawl took is complex, but not nearly as complex as the antidote. I know, because I had the only man who can make it tortured until he told me what it was. Told me all about it, told me its secrets. It contains a whole list of things I couldn't even begin to recall. I had the man killed, of course. Then I had the man who tortured the confession out of him, tortured the antidote's list of ingredients out of him, killed as well. It wouldn't do to have the resourceful Richard Rawl find either man and somehow discover from them what was in the cure. So you see, Excellency, there is no one to make Lord Rawl any more of the antidote.
He held the bottle by the neck and wagged it before the man.
This is the last dose. Lord Rawl's last chance at life.
Through the eyes of a young soldier, Jagang watched the bottle Nicholas dangled before him. Any trace of humor had vanished.
Then Richard Rawl will come here and get it.
Nicholas pulled the cork. He took a whiff. The liquid inside carried the slight aroma of cinnamon.
You think so, Excellency?
Making a great show of it, Nicholas poured the liquid out onto the floor. As Emperor Jagang watched, Nicholas shook the bottle, making sure that the very last drop fell out.
So you see, Excellency, I have everything well in hand. Richard Roll will not be a problem. He will shortly die from the poison if my men don't manage to get him before then. Either way, Richard Roll is a dead man, just as you requested.
Nicholas bowed, as if at the conclusion of a grand performance before an appreciative audience. The man smiled again, a smile of strained forbearance.
"And what of the Mother Confessor?" the Emperor asked.
Nicholas noted the clear undertone of restrained wrath. He was displeased not to be roundly admired for his great accomplishment. After all, this Emperor Jagang had not managed to capture the prize he so keenly sought. Nicholas smiled indulgently.
"Well, the way I see it, Excellency, now that I've told you Lord Roll is soon to join the ranks of the Keeper's flock in the underworld, I have no assurance that you will keep your part of the bargain. I would like a commitment on your part before I give you the Mother Confessor."
"What makes you think you can capture her?"
"Oh, I have that well in hand. Her own nature will deliver her into my hands."
"Her own nature?"
"You let me worry about that, Excellency. All you need to know is that I will deliver the Mother Confessor to you alive, as promised. You might say that the Lord Roll was free, a gift on my part, but you will have to pay the price if you are to have the prize you covet, the Mother Confessor."
"And what will be your price?"
Nicholas strolled around the man in the center of the room. He gestured with the empty antidote bottle at the surroundings.
"Not my idea of the proper way to live, if one has to live."
"So you would have riches as a reward for doing your duty to the Creator, to the Imperial Order, and to your Emperor?"
The way Nicholas saw it, he had done more than his duty that night in the woods with the sisters. Instead of saying so, he shrugged.
"Well, I will let you have the rest of the world you have fought so hard to gain. I only want Dahara, an empire of worth for my own."
"You wish to rule the land of Dahara?"
Nicholas performed an exaggerated bow.
"Under you, of course, Excellency." He straightened. "I will rule as you do, through fear and terror. All in the name of sacrificing for the betterment of mankind."
The dreamwalker watched through the eyes of the frightened soldier. The glint in those eyes was looking dangerous again.
"You play a risky game, Slide, making such demands. Your life must mean little to you."
Nicholas showed the Emperor a smile that said he was tiring of trifling.
"Hate to live, live to hate."
Finally, the Emperor's smile returned to the man's lips.
"Dahara is your wish?"
"It is done.
Lord Roll dead, and the Mother Confessor delivered to me alive, and you will then have Dahara to do with as you wish, as long as you pay homage to the rule of the Imperial Order."
Nicholas indulged Jagang with a more polite smile as he bowed his head.
"But of course."
"Then when Richard Roll is dead and I have the Mother Confessor, you shall be named Emperor Nicholas of the land of Dahara."
"You are a wise emperor."
This was the man who had prescribed Nicholas's fate. This was the man who had sent those sisters to practice their vile craft, to sunder him with the terrible agony of destroying who he had been, to mother him in an agonizing second creation. They had decreed that he sacrifice himself to their cause. Nicholas had had no say in it. Now, at least, for the small task of dealing with the petty enemies of the Order, he would have his reward. He would have riches and power that he could never have dared imagine before he had been reborn. They had destroyed him, but they had created him again more powerful than he had ever been. Now, he was but one step away from being Emperor Nicholas. It had been a bitter road. Driven by angry need, by hatred, Nicholas thrust out his hand as he thrust his own mind, like a hot dagger, into the mind of this man before him, into the spaces between his thoughts, into the marrow of his soul. He hungered to feel the slick heat of this other spirit slide into his own, the hot rush of taking him while Jigang was still within the man's mind. But there was nothing there. In that spark of time, Jigang had already slipped away. The man crashed to the floor, dead. Nicholas, Emperor Nicholas, smiled at the game, only just begun. He was beginning to wonder if he had set the price too low. Chapter 51. As they made their way up the street, Kaelin glanced to the small windows in the surrounding buildings. In the gathering darkness, she doubted that the faces she saw appearing out of the windows could tell much about the people they saw out in the street. But she pulled the hood of her cloak forward anyway. From the stories the men had told, it was not safe to be a woman in Bandakar, so Kaelin, Jensen, and Kara covered their identity to draw as little attention as possible. Kaelin knew that people in fear for their own lives sometimes tried to shift attention away from themselves by offering another to the wolves. Worse, she also knew that there were bitter people devoted to the morbid ideal of the perpetual cannibalism of appeasement that they defined as peace. Richard slowed and checked the alley as they passed. One hand gripped the front of his simple black cloak so that, if need be, he could lift it open and draw his sword. Their men were spread out so as not to appear to be a mob moving through Northwick. Any gathering of crowds of men, except in markets, would no doubt be reported and swiftly draw the attention of the Imperial Order soldiers. They had timed their entry into the city to be just as night fell, so as to better obscure them, yet not so late that their presence in the streets would be suspicious. "There," Owen said as they reached the corner, tilting his head to the right. "Down that way." Richard looked back over his shoulder to make sure that everyone was still with him, then turned down the narrow street. The buildings in the city were mostly single-story, but they were entering a district where a number had a second story, usually hanging several feet out over the street. Kaelin saw nothing taller than the squat two-story buildings. The area they had turned into reeked with the stench of sewage in a small ditch to the side. The dusty streets of Northwick kept making her cough. She imagined that when it rained, the place turned into a quagmire that stank even worse. She saw that Richard made a great effort not to cough. It wasn't always possible. At least when he did, he wasn't coughing up blood. As they kept to the shadows in under the overhangs and eaves, Kaelin moved up closer to him. Jensen followed right behind. Anson, out ahead, scouted their route, looking for all the world as though he were by himself. Richard scanned the sky again. It was empty. They hadn't seen any black-tipped races since before they started up the pass into Bandakar. Kaelin and Kara were glad not to see the huge black birds. Richard, though, seemed as troubled by not seeing them as he once was when he did. Kara hung back a bit, along with a half-dozen men. Tom and some others were moving up a parallel street, yet other men who knew where they were headed made their way through the city by a different route. Even though there were less than 50 in their force, such numbers together could bring attention and trouble. For now, they didn't need trouble. They needed the antidote. "Where is the city center?" Kaelin asked Owen when she got close enough to be able to speak in a low voice. Owen swept his arm around, indicating the street they were on. "This is the place. These shops are where the major commerce is, where people come. In the open squares, the people sometimes set up markets." Kaelin saw a leather shop, a bakery, a place that sold cloth, but nothing more elaborate. "This is the center of your great city? These post-and-beam buildings with living quarters over the shops? This is your major business center?" "Yes," Owen said, sounding half-puzzled and half-proud. Kaelin let out a sigh, but didn't comment. Richard did. "This is the result of your advanced culture?" He gestured around at the shabby daub and wattle buildings. In close to 3,000 years, this is what your great culture has accomplished? This is what you have managed to build? Owen smiled. Yes, it is magnificent, is it not? Instead of answering the question, Richard said, I thought you were in Alterang. I was. Well, even that dingy place was far more advanced than this city of Northwick. It was? I am sorry, Lord Rawl, but I did not see much of Alterang. I was afraid to go far into such a place, and I did not stay for long. Owen looked back at Kaelin. Do you mean to say that the city where you are from is more magnificent than this one? Kaelin blinked at the man. How could she possibly explain Adendrill, the Wizard's Keep, the Confessor's Palace, the palaces on King's Row? The People's Palace, the marble and granite work, the soaring columns, the noble works of art, or any of 100 other places and sites to a man who thought straw and dung buildings were an example of advanced culture. In the end, she decided that this was not the time to try. Owen, I hope that when we are all free of the oppression of the Imperial Order, Richard and I can show you and your people some other places in the world outside of Bandakar, show you some other centers of major commerce and art, some of what mankind elsewhere has accomplished. Owen smiled. I would like that, Mother Confessor. I would like it very much. He stopped abruptly. Oh, here is the place. It is down here. A head-high wooden gate weathered to a brownish gray barred the alleyway beyond from sight. Richard checked both ways up the street, looking to see if anyone was watching. The street was empty of everyone but their men. As he kept an eye on the street, he pushed the gate open enough to allow Owen to slip through. Owen poked his head back out. Come, it is clear. Richard gave a hand signal to the men up at the corner. He put his arm around Kaelin's waist, holding her close, as he squeezed with her through the gate into the alley. The walls of the buildings on either side that came to the edge of the narrow, dusty alleyway had no windows. Some of the tightly packed structures that weren't set so far back had room for small backyards. As they moved cautiously up the alley, more of their men poured in through the gate at the far end. Chickens penned in one of the yards flapped their wings in fright at the people moving close by. Jensen pulled Betty along by her rope, keeping the goat close so she wouldn't cause any trouble. Betty remained quiet, seeming nervous in the strange surroundings of a city. She wasn't even wagging her tail as she peered up at Richard, Kaelin, and Jensen for reassurance as they moved deeper into the heart of the jumble of buildings. Tom appeared at the other end of the alleyway, bringing another group of men. Richard signaled for them to spread out and wait at that end of the alleyway. Kara came up from behind, the hood of her cloak pulled up like Kaelin and Jensen's. I don't like it.
Good,
Richard whispered in answer.
Good?
Kara asked. You think it's good that I don't like this place?
Yes,
Richard said. If you were ever happy and unconcerned, then I'd be worried. Kara twisted her mouth with a reply she decided to keep to herself.
Here,
Owen said, grabbing Richard's arm to stop him. Richard looked where Owen had pointed and then stared down at the man.
This is a palace?
Owen nodded.
One of them. We have several palaces. I told you we are an advanced culture.
Richard gave Kaelin a sidelong glance but said nothing. From what Kaelin could see in the dim light, the backyard was dry dirt with clumps of grass growing here and there. A wooden stairway at the back of the building led up to a small balcony with a door onto the second floor. As they passed through a short gate into the yard, Kaelin saw that under the stairs there was a stairwell going down. Owen looked around, then leaned close.
They are downstairs. This is where they are hiding, the Wise One.
Richard scanned the alley and the surrounding buildings. He rubbed his fingertips across his brow. And the antidote is in there? Owen nodded.
Do you wish to wait while I go get it?
Richard shook his head. We'll go with you. Kaelin held his arm, wishing she could do more to comfort his pain. The best thing, though, was to get the antidote. The sooner they rid him of the poison, the sooner he could deal with solving the problem of the headaches caused by the gift. Some of their men waited nearby. She saw in their eyes their fear of being back in a city where the Imperial Order soldiers had control.
She didn't know what she and Richard could do to help them free their people of those troops, but she intended to come up with something. Were it not for her desperate act, no matter how unwitting, these people would not be suffering and dying at the hands of the Order. The last gray glow of twilight made Richard's eyes look as if they were made of steel. He pulled Jensen close. "Why don't you and Tom stay out here with Betty and stand watch? Stay under the concealment of the stairs and balcony. If you see any soldiers, come let us know." Jensen nodded. "I'll let Betty graze on the grass. It would look more natural if any patrols pass by." "Just keep out of sight," he said. "If soldiers see a young woman like you, they won't hesitate to snatch you." "I'll keep her out of sight," Tom said as he came up into the yard. He aimed a thumb over his shoulder. "I have the men spread out so they won't be so noticeable." Kalen and Kara followed Richard and Owen toward the back of the building. At the stairwell down, Owen paused when Richard instead went to the door into the building. "This way, Lord Rawl." "I know. Wait while I check the hallway inside. Make sure it is clear."
"It is just empty rooms where people sometimes meet."
"I want to check it anyway. Kara, wait here with Kalen." Kalen followed Richard to the door under the balcony.
"I'm going with you."
Kara was right on Kalen's heels. "If you want to check the hall," she told Richard, "then you may come with us." After a quick glance at Kalen's eyes, he didn't argue with her. Looking at Kara, he said, "Sometimes." Kara flashed him a defiant smile. "You wouldn't know what to do without me." Kalen saw that as he turned to the door, he couldn't help but smile. Her heart lifted at seeing Richard smile, and then she felt a sudden pang of sorrow for Kara, knowing how she must miss General Myford with their army far to the north in Dahara. It wasn't often that a Mord Sith could come to care about someone the way Kalen knew Kara cared about Benjamin. Kara wouldn't come out and admit it, though, and had put first her wish to protect Richard and Kalen. When she and Kara had been back with that army, Kalen had promoted the then-captain to general after a battle in which they had lost a number of officers. Captain Myford had risen to the occasion. Since then, he had held their army together. While she had complete faith in him, she also feared for his well-being, as Kara certainly must. Kalen wondered if they would ever again see the young general. Richard opened the door a crack and peered into the dark hallway beyond. It was empty. Kara, a jeel in hand, pushed through and entered ahead of them, wanting to be sure that it was safe. Kalen followed Richard in. There were two doors to each side. At the far end of the hall stood a door with a small window.
"What's out there?"
Kalen whispered as Richard looked through the window. "The street. I see some of our men." On the way back, Richard checked rooms on one side, while Kara checked the rooms on the other. They were all empty, just as Owen had said.
"This might be a good place to hide our men," Kara said.
Richard nodded. "That's what I was thinking. We could make strikes from here, from their midst, rather than risk being spotted coming in from the countryside to attack." Before they reached the back door, Richard suddenly stumbled, banging a shoulder against the wall before going to one knee. Kalen and Kara grabbed for him, keeping him from falling on his face.
"What's wrong?"
Kara whispered. He paused a moment, apparently waiting for a bout of pain to lift. His fingers squeezing Kalen's arm hurt so much that her eyes were watering, but she made herself remain silent.
I just got dizzy for a minute,"
he panted, trying to recover his breath.
"The dark hall, I guess."
His fingers released their vice-like grip on Kalen's arm.
"Second state. That's what Owen called it. He said that the second state of the poison was dizziness."
Richard looked up at her in the dark.
"I'm all right. Let's go get the antidote."
Owen, waiting in the shadows in the stairwell, started down when they reached him. At the bottom of the stairs, he pushed the door open and looked in.
"They are still here," he said with relief. "The speakers are still here. I recognize some of their voices. The Wise One must still be here with them. They have not moved to another hiding place, as I feared they might."
Owen was hoping the great speakers would agree to help rid their people of the Imperial Order. After they had refused in the past, Kalen didn't think they would agree this time, but then Owen and his men had not at first agreed to fight. Owen believed that with the commitment of the men they had, and with what had happened in his town,
the assembly of speakers would see that there was a chance of being free again and would be more open to hearing what had to be done. Many of the men shared Owen's confidence that help was at hand. More important than talking to the speakers, as far as Kalin was concerned, was that this was where the second bottle of antidote was hidden. That came above all else. They had to secure the antidote. Whenever she thought about the possibility of Richard dying, it made her knees tremble. At the door, just inside the small vestibule, Owen rapped gently on the door. Soft candlelight came from inside when the door pulled in a crack. A man peered out for a moment, then his eyes went wide.
Owen?
Kalin didn't think the man intended to open the door. Before he had a chance to think it over, Richard pushed the door open and moved into the room. The man hastily backed out of Richard's way. Richard pulled Kara close. Guard the door. None of these people comes out unless I say so. Kara nodded and took up a position outside the door.
What is the meaning of this?
The man inside demanded of Owen as he gaped in fear at Richard and Kalin.
Great speaker, it is vital that we speak with all of you.
The place was aglow with candles. A dozen and a half men sitting around on rugs sipping tea or leaning against pillows lining the walls abruptly fell silent. The stone walls were the outer foundation of the building. Stone piers marched in two lines down the center of the large room, supporting fat beams that Richard's head easily cleared. There was no decoration. It looked like little more than a basement made more comfortable with rugs and pillows where the men congregated at one end of the extensive room. Simple wooden tables against the walls at one end held candles. Some of the men rose to their feet.
Owen, one of them said in grave reprimand, you have been banished. What are you doing here?
Honored speaker, we are well past petty issues of banishment.
He held out an introductory hand.
These are friends of mine from outside our land.
Kalin grabbed Owen's shirt at the shoulder and pulled his ear close as she gritted her teeth.
Antidote!
Owen nodded apologetically. The men, all older, watched indignantly as Owen went to the corner at the far right. He grasped a stone near chest height and twisted it side to side. The men stared openly at Kalin when she pushed the hood of her cloak back. Richard reached in and helped Owen wiggle the stone loose. When he finally pulled the heavy block out far enough to turn it to the side, Owen reached in behind and came out with the bottle. He wasted no time in handing it to Richard. When Richard pulled the cork, Kalin detected the slight aroma of cinnamon. Richard downed the contents.
You must leave, one of the men growled. You are not welcome here.
Owen didn't back down.
We must see the wise one.
What?
The men of the order have invaded our land. They are torturing and murdering our people. Others they have taken away.
Nothing can be done about this,
the red-faced speaker said.
We do as we must so that our people can go on with their lives. We do as we must to avoid violence.
We have ended violence, Owen told the man. At least, in our town, we killed all the men of the order who held us in the grip of fear, who raped and tortured and murdered our people. Our people there are now free of these men of the order. We must fight back and free the rest of our people. It is your duty as speakers to do right by our people and not accommodate their enslavement.
The great speakers were apoplectic.
We will hear none of this.
We will speak of it with the wise one and see what he has to say.
No, the wise one will not see you. Never. You are all denied. You must leave.
Chapter 52. One of the men came forward and angrily seized a fistful of Richard's shirt, trying to push him out.
You are the cause of this. You are an outsider, a savage, one of the unenlightened. You have brought profane ideas among our people.
He did his best to shake Richard.
You have seduced our people to violence.
Richard snatched the speaker's wrist and wrenched his arm around, taking him to his knees. The man cried out in pain. Without letting up, Richard leaned down toward him.
We have risked our lives helping your people. Your people are not enlightened, but people the same as anyone else. You are going to listen to us.
This night, the future of you and your people will be shaped.
Richard released the man with a shove, then went to the door and stuck his head out.
Kara, go ask Tom to help you get all the rest of the men to come down here. I think they had better all be part of this.
As Kara ran to spread the word that Richard wanted all the men to gather in the basement of the palace, he ordered the speakers back against the wall.
You have no right to do this, one protested.
You are the representatives of the people of Bandakar. You are their leaders, Richard told them. The time has come for you to lead.
Behind, men started filing into the candlelit room. It wasn't long before they were all quietly assembled. The basement was large enough that Owen's men took up only part of the available space. Kalin saw other unfamiliar people straggle in as well. Knowing the nature of these people and since Kara was letting them in, Kalin didn't think that they presented a threat. Richard gestured toward the quiet gathering, watching the speakers.
These men from the town of Witherton have faced the truth of what is happening to their people. They will no longer tolerate such brutality. They will no longer be victims. They wish to be free.
One of the speakers, a man with a narrow, pointed chin, huffed dismissively.
Freedom can never work. It only gives people license to be self-centered. A thoughtful person dedicated to the welfare of an enlightened mankind must reject the immoral concept of freedom for what it is, selfish.
That's right, another agreed. Such simplistic beliefs can only provoke a cycle of violence. This silly notion of freedom leads to viewing things as black or white. Such uninspired morals are obsolete. Individuals have no right to judge others, especially in such authoritarian terms. What is needed is compromise among all sides, if there is to be peace.
Compromise?
Richard asked. A cycle of violence can only exist if you grant all people, including those who are evil, moral equivalence. If you say that everyone, including those who decide to harm others, has an equal right to exist. That is what you do when you refuse to crush evil. You give moral standing and power to those who murder. Devotion to compromise in such arenas is a sick idea that says you must cut off a finger, and then a leg, and then an arm, to feed the monster living among you. Evil feeds on the good. If you kill the monster, the violence ends. You have two choices before you. Choose to live in cringing fear on your knees, apologizing endlessly for wishing to be allowed to live as you struggle to appease an ever-expanding evil, or eliminate those who would harm you and free yourselves to live your own lives, which means you must remain vigilant, ever ready to protect yourself.
One of the speakers, his eyes going wide, lifted an arm to point at Richard.
I know you now. You are the one who is named in prophecy. You are the one that prophecy says will destroy us.
Whispers carried the accusation back through the crowd. Richard gazed back at his gathered men, then directed a withering glare at the speakers.
I am Richard Rawl. You're right. I am the one named in the prophecy given to you people long ago. Your destroyer will come, and he will redeem you. You're right. This prophecy is about me. But if I had not come along, it would eventually have been another who would have fulfilled those words, whether in another year or another 1,000 years, because these words are really about man's honorable commitment to life. Your people were banished because they refused to see the truth of the world around them. They chose to close their minds to reality. I have ended that blindness.